dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing for the war for the free world. A battle space in that war, of course, is the condition of the United States military, its ability to perform the various missions we charge it with, both deterrence in the first instance and, of course, should the need arise, combat operations. The readiness of our military to perform those combat missions is, of course, central to deterrence in the first instance and the probability of success should, regrettably, war be necessary. A woman who has studied this matter closely, the readiness of the U.S. military, and done arguably as much as anybody, certainly outside of uniform, to assure the readiness of our military, is our first guest. Her name is Elaine Donnelly. She is president and founder of an incredibly important organization, the Center for Military Readiness. She has been active on many fronts, but is, of course, at the moment particularly engaged on a vote that is likely to take place today in the House of Representatives, a non-binding resolution concerning, well, effectively overturning the direction of the Commander-in-Chief, Donald Trump, to exclude transgender individuals from the United States military by essentially suggesting that they have a right to serve. Elaine, I'm so grateful to you for finding a few minutes for us on a very busy day, but quickly, just remind us what the problem is with transgender individuals in the military.
The problem is Congress. They are not taking this issue seriously. The Department of Defense is very close to winning a victory in the courts. The courts are very likely to uphold the Trump-Mattis policy as constitutional. But in the meantime, here we have members of Congress voting on a resolution as we speak that tells the armed forces, you should disobey the commander-in-chief. You should disregard the new policy. You should pretend like this is a civil rights issue when it's really a national defense issue. And here you have all these liberals in Congress that even though it's non-binding, it's quite serious, and it's really an affront to the military, and it shows a lack of understanding of how important our national defense is. For members of Congress, any member of Congress, to say that we believe that the military should defy the president, the commander-in-chief, on a policy that was formulated after 6 months of study. It is a nuanced policy. It is not a blanket ban on transgenders in the military, identifying as transgender, but without gender dysphoria to serve in their biological gender. If they've been stable for 36 months and meet requirements for deployability, it would disqualify persons with gender dysphoria from military service and retain those few who were grandfathered in, people who came out during the previous administration.
But Elaine, let me just ask you, because I want to make sure we all are clear, what gender dysphoria is and why it represents such a problem for military service?
It's a serious psychological condition. It involves confusion about gender identity and pain and anxiety that comes with that confusion. It has a very high risk of suicide. Quite often when there are treatments, whether hormone treatments or even surgeries to remove healthy body parts, those problems don't go away. Gender dysphoria is a disqualifying factor. But if a person is stable, if they serve in their biological gender, then they can serve. And anyone with gender dysphoria, no, this is one of many disqualifying factors, physical and psychological, that say you are not eligible to serve in the armed forces.
And the reason for that is, in addition to having a psychological disorder and perhaps as a result being susceptible to suicide or anxiety or other conditions that would make you less than an ideal candidate to be carrying weapons and, you know, engaging in strenuous physical activity. There's the problem of the treatments to which these people are subjected that makes them non-deployable, isn't there? And how does that factor into the military's evaluation of this problem and judgment?
The Department of Defense, when they studied this issue for 6 months, looked at actual data, what happened with persons identifying as transgender during the previous administration. And they found that there was considerable amounts of time, 5.5 months averaging in the Air Force and the Army, time off for hormone treatments, for recovery from surgeries, various things that interfere with deployability. Some of the commanders actually reported that they had to get into maintenance and operational funds to pay for travel for the special treatments of people identifying as transgender and people with gender dysphoria. These are costs that interfere with readiness. The time lost interferes with readiness. And the Secretary of Defense said to the President, we need a new policy. It's a nuanced policy. It is not a blanket ban, but it's one that has a good chance of being upheld as constitutional before the federal courts.
Unless, of course, the Congress mucks it up. And Elaine, our colleague Jesse Jane Duff has made one other point, a former gunnery sergeant in the United States Marine Corps, and that is that when you are putting money into trying to perform sex change operations or provide medication or counseling or whatever else to people who are not deployable, you actually are having a space that needs to be filled by somebody who is deployable held by somebody who isn't. So you've got a real impact on the units in which these people are deployed, their readiness, as you know so well, but also their morale and cohesion, don't you?
Exactly. The time loss affects everyone else. There's also this issue of privacy. When you have people who are biological males claiming the right to be in the private spaces of women, that impacts on women, and it's worse in the military because you can't just leave. If you're serving on a Navy ship and all of a sudden there's a biological male there using the private facilities of the women, it not only inconveniences everyone else, it causes a serious problem for everyone else. This kind of policy should not be approved, and Congress needs to do the right thing and back off from this ridiculous resolution.
And just to be clear, this was something that was brought to us by Barack Obama, who had his own engineering of the military as a priority. It was at odds with past practice and common sense, and certainly, as you've argued so persuasively, with what the future needs of the United States military are. So the particularly worrying thing, as I understand it, Elaine, is not so much this non-binding resolution, which will presumably pass in the House today, but the fact that that sets the predicate for binding statutory direction in future pieces of legislation. Elaine, your leadership on all of these matters and that of the Center for Military Readiness that you lead so well is deeply appreciated. I know you'll keep it up. Come back to us after the vote. Let's take stock. Next up, we'll speak with Diana West about the Mueller investigation and James Comey's curious stance. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by one of our country's most thoughtful commentators, observers, analysts, and, well, creative intellects, I think it's fair to say, especially about things that bear on the culture, our society, and our national security. She is, of course, the great Diana West. She is the author most recently of The Red Thread, investigation of the ideological drivers behind the anti-Trump conspiracy. She's also the author of two other great books, The Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her writings these days at dianawest.net and Epic Times and The Daily Caller and elsewhere. She's always a welcome guest here. Diana, thank you so much for giving us a little of your time today.
Oh, wonderful to be with you. So much to talk about.
There is a lot to talk about, not least the, well, conclusion. I'm not sure it's the end, but the conclusion of the Mueller investigation with the issuance to the Attorney General of a report, which we are told by the Attorney General found there was no evidence of the Trump campaign, the Trump transition team, the Trump presidency, or President Trump engaged in collusion with the Russians. What do you make of that?
Well, we already knew that. And I think that that is something we need to keep in mind here. We've been going through this for so long in terms of looking at the mechanics of this through various ways, whether it's the House Intelligence Committee, various reports that have made this finding pretty clear to people. And knowing that the Mueller report itself, the special counsel itself, was conceived as a political act of war against this presidency, as I see it, the report itself cannot suddenly be transformed into some kind of valid investigation summation. This is another political act. And indeed, I was quite shocked to read our friend Andy McCarthy's column yesterday at Fox News, where he discussed, it really set forth in very clear chronological fashion with using documentation of the FISA warrants and so on to make a very compelling case that Robert Mueller knew there was no Russian collusion at least 18 months ago. When you think about that, and I mean, it's very shocking to see that set forth in print. I suspect it was the case as of day one, because if we remember, the whole special counsel investigation was ginned up through the chicanery of Mueller's, as they call him, law enforcement twin, James Comey's strategic leaking that set the whole process off. So if we understand this all as a continuation of this sort of political warfare, we have to look at the report and try to evaluate it. I see the so-called exoneration, as some call it, but this finding of no Russian collusion, almost as a distraction, something that we're chasing, and a lot of people, you know, rightfully so, feeling relief and excited about it on one level. However, what I notice is they're doubling down on what I consider to be, at the very least, an unproven case that the Russians hacked the DNC and set forth all of these evidence trails that are still being used to justify the case against Trump. And this should trigger in everyone's mind the recognition Robert Mueller is a political animal. And what we go back to, I believe, is we are looking at a regrouping as he goes back to his career mission. We can go back to the 1990s and see the same career mission in Robert Mueller's professional life. He is protecting the deep state from revelations that of their role in a criminal conspiracy to overturn an election. That's how I'm looking at it, and I'm you know, watching to see if my theory holds, but I think we have to look at this as strategy, not exoneration or a conclusion of an investigation. This is a strategic pivot.
Yeah. This is fascinating, Diana, and needless to say, in certain circles this will be very controversial, but I suspect your instincts, born of your own deep investigation of the individuals involved. You've mentioned two of them, of course, Robert Mueller and James Comey, the former director of the FBI. You have a sense of the ideological motivations behind this. And this is, of course, the subject of your new book, The Red Thread, from the Center for Security Policy Press, I'm pleased to say. Diana, just so tie that in, if you would. What is it? You've talked about Robert Mueller's felt responsibility to protect the deep state, but in the book, you talk about the feelings of these, well, revolutionaries, certainly John Brennan and James Comey and Nellie Orr and the like, who, you know, were determined to thwart, first of all, the presidential ambitions of Donald Trump and subsequently his rise to presidency, to power as the president. What is the tie-in between that motivation and the kind of activities that you're talking about now, the strategic pivot, the shiny dangling object to distract us, whatever you want to describe it as, that is now clearly at work.
Well, I think we're looking at a continuation of this effort to neutralize Donald Trump. That may seem paradoxical because we're also looking at this as a halt on this particular vector of the assault, namely the Russian collusion story. But remember Andy McCarthy's discussion 18 months ago. He's pegging the fact that Robert Mueller understood this wasn't there was no Russian collusion. So we have to look at it again as a strategic move in terms of putting it together with why is this effort going, and why are these same people involved whom we've seen over decades now? We're seeing the same people involved in running our country, running the bureaucracy, running the intelligence services, and so on. Why are they still motivated in such absolutely extra-legal, extra-normal, or abnormal ways in terms of American politics against Donald Trump? And I think it goes to the fact that Donald Trump remains a counter-revolutionary figure. Our first counter-revolutionary figure to emerge in the aftermath of World War II. I mean, that's a very long time we're talking about in terms of somebody who is really attempting and just instinctively, legislatively, with his program, everything about him, his personality, to reverse this essential movement toward globalism, one world government for some, global arrangements for others, multilateralism, et cetera, et cetera.
For others, let's call it what it is, communist or socialist global order.
It's world socialism. It is world socialism, and it has been prevalent. We have seen the governments emerge in Europe in the aftermath of World War II, largely socialist. We've seen socialism included in our own government increasingly over the years, although we don't until recently even think of it in those terms. And so here we have this same sort of lightning rod in Donald Trump, which does call to mind the work I've done in the Red Thread to expose these anti-Trump conspirators as hardcore socialists, Marxists, progressives, and so on, who are at root anti-American in their approach to seizing power. I mean, this is not the way the Constitution or the Federal Code sets forth the way people participate in politics.
Not in a republic like ours, that's for sure. And Diana, just to bring this home, we're now going to see, I think you're correct in forecasting, a kind of doubling down, a determined effort to try to prevent the Trump presidency from emerging from this exoneration, as the president has called it, by essentially throwing up a barrage of new charges, new investigations, new, sort of the Lilliputians trying to tie him down. So just if you've got a prescription, what's to be done for those of us who love this country and who want the president to succeed in restoring, an America first agenda, as he's described it, that respects our Constitution, that guarantees our freedoms and protects us particularly from this sort of onslaught from the globalists and the radical left, that matter, the Islamists with whom they're allied and so on?
I think number one, first and foremost, is loud, angry, strong, overwhelming demonstrations of support and demands for action of the lawmakers we have who want to pursue this to the limit in terms of unmasking the anti-Trump conspirators, no matter where the trail leads. You see people like Representative Devin Nunes, the great hero of this in the House. We're seeing Rand Paul in the Senate stepping up and issuing all kinds of statements about wanting to, take this forward and bring this to book. We cannot forgive and forget here. And I feel that effort. You see Karl Rove, people like that already talking about let it go, let's move on, let's govern the country. All of this will be coming at us from all quarters, all political sides of the spectrum. And this must be resisted. This needs to be to the best of everyone's ability. We have to let the sun shine in. All the documents from the Mueller report to the FISA warrants need to come out. this absolutely has to be a house cleaning top to bottom. And, you know, everything that individual citizens can bring to bear on their representatives to keep them strong and on this path is really our own, I think, our only ticket to any kind of political salvation here and moral salvation.
Yeah. And legal salvation, too, needless to say, the rule of law. Dinah, we have to leave it at that. Alas, there is so much more to talk about, but we'll do it with you next week. In the meantime, congratulations again on what seems to be the great success, the high acclaim that you're now getting for The Red Thread. I commend it to all of you. I hope you'll buy it at Amazon, but you can also find it for free at securefreedom.org. Dinah, bless you. Great to talk with you. Let's do it again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Charles. We'll talk with him about border issues. We'll talk with him about transgenders and much more right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we're joined by Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State with responsibility for narcotics and close scrutiny of how they get into our country and what they do once they're here to our people. Robert is, among other things, a veteran of tours in the White House, President Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Professor of law at Harvard University, former naval intelligence officer, among many other marvelous credentials. We're always delighted to have him with us. Robert, welcome back. Good to have you.
Frank, thank you for talking about these important issues. They really matter.
Well, I appreciate you doing so. Specifically, I want to thank you for joining us as a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. You were unable to attend the rollout event, which we'll talk about in a moment with Bill Gertz, who was there. But you made a contribution, which was very important. We've talked a little bit about it on air in the past, but I did want to give you another chance to visit with us about it, because one of the things born of your experience at the State Department and your work in this space more generally, Bobby, is the Chinese use of fentanyl, perhaps as revenge for what the Brits did with opium to China back in the day, but with murderous effect. They're bringing this lethal drug into our country for no purpose, it would seem, other than killing us. That's a kind of chemical warfare, as I think you put it in your statement. Tell us a little bit about it and why it's going on and what we could do about it.
I think you put your finger, Frank, on a very important element of what is a larger, important sort of overlapping set of issues, China and the drug crisis. You know, parsing motivations for the Chinese is always difficult, but I will say that it's a straightforward issue. We have more than 600 producers over there of fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times, depending on the purity, more dangerous than heroin. And we know that in a communist country of that nature, they can shut it down in a blink if they wish to do so, or they can promote it. And of course, it gets into this country. It's been the primary driver of overdoses. I was just at a 3-day conference in which this issue was highlighted at some length. But the people, of course, in the room were all those that already knew about it. And I think one of the biggest problems we have is the Chinese are doing what, in many ways, Khrushchev said that a communist government, he thought it would be the Soviet Union, would one day do to us, which is to allow us to be consumed by our own failures, and in particular, the drug crisis. And so what you have right now is we lost 47,000 people to synthetic opioids last year, more than 70,000 total to the drug crisis, more incidentally than we lost in Vietnam. And the truth be told, the Chinese know very well what they're doing. And I would argue that what the president ought to do, Lighthizer is over there right now, together with Mnuchin, I think, and what they ought to be doing is saying, look, we do believe that fair trade is critical. We do believe that you need to square the table here and stop cheating at the WTO and a bunch of other places. But bottom line is, we think there ought to be a codicil here on your commitment to, and we'll know whether they can live up to it or not, your commitment to shut down these fentanyl mills and shut down the precursors that are coming. A lot of them, the Chinese also send precursors over, which end up in Mexico, which end up allowing the Mexicans to create a sort of Mexican version of the Chinese fentanyl and send it in. And a lot of this is also coming in through the postal service and through transshipment by mail. So the bottom line is, if you look away from the fire, it will consume you. And we need to look into the fire. We need to say this is a major problem.
We need to be putting the fire out. And as you say, Bobby, this government in China is directly responsible for it, because clearly the kind of control they're now exercising over their population, especially the intensified surveillance practices and the like, would mean this wouldn't be happening without their consent.
Absolutely right. If you can do artificial intelligence to the extreme of literally monitoring by facial recognition everybody in a city, and they're doing that in one location right now, you can absolutely shut down these fentanyl operations.
And they're going to do it countrywide and probably export that capability elsewhere too, for that matter. Very worrying stuff. Hey, Bobby, I need to switch gears because we're going to run out of time before we run out of topics with you. I did want to ask you, the House of Representatives the other day voted to try to override the veto President Trump cast on legislation that would have vitiated, that is to say, negated his emergency declaration concerning what's happening across our southern border. Again, in your previous life at the State Department, and of course these days as a commentator for Fox News and other outlets, you've been following very closely what's happening at the border. I was struck not by the fact so much that Democrats voted in bloc to override the president, but that 14 Republican members of Congress voted with them to do so. I've come to think of these as Republicans for open borders, but what is up with Republicans who think that this isn't a national emergency, or at the very least are willing to align themselves with people who are determined to thwart the president's efforts to try to deal with it?
They're spending too much time watching CNN, Frank. The facts, the data is straight up. If you go down and look at the numbers crossing the border, more than 2,000 on most days, and you look at where they end up, a lot of them in sanctuary cities, and you look at the percentage of that group that are tied to gangs or drug traffickers, really identifiable drug trafficking organizations, and you look at the impact of that inflow on the United States, you can't help but understand this is a national security concern. It is in the president's legal jurisdiction to describe what is and is not a national emergency. And by the way, we have literally a couple of dozen rolling national emergencies that go back three or four decades. I think it's a term of art that people misunderstand. We're not saying that an asteroid is going to take out Cincinnati. We're saying that this is something that is of a magnitude legally that warrants the president taking executive action in the near term in order to effectuate a solution. And that's what he's doing. And thank God he's doing it. I mean, at the end of the day, the facts speak louder than any opinion.
Well, they do speak louder, and they need to be heard is the point.
I think these Republicans have been cowed in some ways by the onslaught of the 24/7, maybe it's even 48/7 media that has beat this president up every way from Sunday. A lot of this gratuitous attack mentality has got to stop. And when you stop it and the snow globe settles and you look at what the facts are, there's no question that our southern border is unprotected, needs to be protected by a combination of high technology and a wall of some kind.
Right. In the right places. Yeah. Robbie, let me ask you about one other issue that I know you have had to wrestle with, having served in uniform yourself, and that is a proposition that is before the House today, as it happens. By the time we air this program, it will have occurred, presumably. But I spoke with Elaine Donnelly of the Center for Military Readiness about it a short while ago, and I'd like to get your thoughts of a man who's been in the uniform of the United States Navy. The advisability of the House of Representatives telling the President of the United States that they disagree with his reinstating, basically, the longstanding prohibition on people with a mental disorder known as gender dysphoria, so-called transgender individuals, from serving in the United States military. And not just that, but they're directing him, essentially directing the military in this non-binding resolution in this version to ignore his lawful order. What do you make of all of that?
Well, I think we've departed from common sense. I think at the end of the day, Frank, look, I'm a practicing Christian and as failed as the next person, but that my view is that every human being is an empire and we take care of them and we have empathy for them. But that doesn't mean that every individual with all of their conditions and concerns and anxieties ends up serving in a highly significant role, namely defending the country in uniform. And right now it's all about readiness. It is all about readiness. If readiness is in any way impaired by a condition, it doesn't matter whether you happen to have had a past experience as a schizophrenic or you have an issue that relates to a medical concern or you have a physical, it all has to be evaluated in terms of readiness, because it's at the end of the day, the Russians and the Chinese and whoever are the terrorist organizations that could end up being in an adversarial position, either through surrogates or directly anywhere in the world, don't say, well, it's okay, we'll give that particular moment or time a pass because they are a unit that has a... No, it doesn't work that way. It's all about readiness. You either are able to defend or you're not.
The theory or the implied idea, it seems, is that everybody has a right to serve in the United States Armed Forces. Now, you have. You know that the all-volunteer force requires you to want to serve, for sure, but you do have to meet certain physical and mental and other requirements. And that doesn't translate into a right to serve, does it?
No, it doesn't. Absolutely right about it. Look, the way it works is it is a privilege to serve. It is a right to be a patriotic American, and it's probably also a duty to be a patriotic American. But at the end of the day, the United States military has requirements in every designator, in every, if you can't pass the test, whatever the test is, then you can't serve in that role. That's why, for example, we have so few people that make it through BUDS as a SEAL in special operations. There's a set of requirements, and you either make it or you don't make it. And if you don't make it, you can go do something else that's good for America. But that's not what you're going to be doing.
Yeah. Amen. Bobby, one last thought. You wrote earlier this week about the president's new declaration concerning free speech on campus. I'm very much concerned about the state of free speech, having had my own aggressively attacked by a lot of others. What is this order doing, and why do you consider it so important?
Well, there are two things it's doing. The first is it's highlighting to the average American that free speech is under fire. And by that, I mean that people, particularly those that I think should have the most curious minds and the greatest freedom to speak freely on the campuses around the country, are being chilled. The second piece of this, which is the president is saying, we not only have a First Amendment, but it's how you implement. A lot of countries around the world have the equivalent of a First Amendment, but they don't implement it. They don't live up to it. They don't abide it. We as Americans have always tried to put our money where our mouth is. That is to say, we've tried to make real and implement the rights that we believe belong.
Unalienable rights from God, to be precise.
That's exactly right.
Bobby, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much. Robert Charles has been our guest. We're always grateful for your time. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with Bill Gertz next, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our tour Inside the Ring, a private guided tour by the author of a prize-winning column at the Washington Times of that name, Bill Gertz. He is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, author of 7 best-selling books, including most recently I War, War and Peace in the Information Age, an extraordinary, not only investigative reporter in the national security space, but a great resource, particularly to this program. We're always grateful for his visits. Bill, welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, thank you. It's good to have you, especially in the week that you reported so handsomely at the Washington Free Beacon on a project we've helped sponsor, that is the new Committee on the Present Danger, China. We were talking about it earlier in the program with one of the members of the committee, Robert Charles. But he wasn't there. You were. Just give us a quick appreciation of how you think it went.
Well, I thought it was a great rollout for an urgently needed project, something that will focus energy and attention on the threat posed by China. We're seeing the debate emerging both within government and in the public sector about how to deal with this threat. And clearly the people that were lined up at the Committee on the Present Danger China are focused on the threat part of it and really educating the American public. It's urgently needed.
Well, we feel so too, needless to say, and your both appreciation of the value of a project like this, as well as your recollection of the important role a similar group played in the Cold War, I think is especially appreciated, Bill, and thank you for bringing it all to the attention of your audience. And by the way, folks, you can see the video of the entirety of the rollout at presentdangerchina.org. I really commend it to you. Let me ask you, Bill, about some of the things you've been covering that are very much related to what we're warning of. One that really caught my eye was your report about the Chinese now having apparently replicated a capability that the Russians have had now for some time of hiding a cruise missile launcher inside a standard shipping container. What are the implications of the Chinese essentially making, well, any of the countless shipping vessels that are on the high seas carrying their goods into weapons platforms?
Yeah, this is a very significant story, and it has strategic implications for the emerging China threat and its relation to the commercial threat from China. Everyone is well aware that China has launched this global Belt and Road Initiative where they're investing more than $1 trillion in infrastructure projects. And this is widely viewed within the intelligence community in the Pentagon as a stalking horse for spreading China's power projection capabilities. And now they've developed a new missile. It's called the YJ-18. It's actually a variant of an anti-ship missile, supersonic at the last stage. And this is, they've turned it into a land attack missile that's disguised in a shipping container. And this is very significant because what it means is that one of the largest freighter fleets in the world will now be able to turn those freighters into missile shooters. And many of China's network of commercial ports into missile bases. Most closest one to us would be in the Bahamas, which would put the United States in range of these missiles. So it's a very significant development, and it's something that a lot of people in government are very concerned about.
Well, Bill, as you know so well, the closest port that they manage to our shores may be in the Bahamas, but those containers from China are in every one of our ports every day. So that's another kettle of fish. And of particular concern to me, we've talked about this before, Bill, is the fact that if not the Chinese at the moment, a company that is tied to, invest in, and owns part of the Russian manufacturer of a similar kind of system is actually managing two U.S. ports at the moment, Port Canaveral in Florida and the Port of Wilmington in Delaware. And, you know, this is a crazy kind of vulnerability that we've created, and I'm afraid we will find them exploiting it at some point to our great detriment. Thank you for calling attention to this, and it certainly fits into some of the warnings that we heard at our rollout event of the Committee on the Present Danger China about the Belt and Road Initiative and the infrastructure that it's building and the strategic choke points that it's trying to basically control. And I think especially as we're watching them make inroads, not just in South Asia and in Africa and in Europe, but also in our own hemisphere, this is of extreme concern. Bill, let me turn to another issue, a good news story, I guess one might say, especially with respect to missile threats from countries like North Korea or Iran or even Russia or China, and that is that we had a successful missile defense test of an unprecedented character the other day by the United States. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Missile Defense Agency and U.S. Northern Command and Air Force Space Command components conducted the first salvo launch, that is more than one, of the ground-based interceptor against a ICBM target 4,000 miles away in Kwajalein Atoll in the Pacific. An ICBM test missile was launched, target missile, and then two interceptors from the Vandenberg Air Force Base missile defense base. We have two, one in Fort Greely, Alaska, and one in Vandenberg. They fired twice and were successful in hitting, first of all, this high-speed, ultra-high-speed warhead in space, and then the second missile was able to home in on some remaining debris and destroy that as well. So it was a major milestone for the Pentagon's system. In addition, the Pentagon, just on Friday, they let the contract for $4.1 billion to Boeing to begin expanding the missile defense base up at Fort Greely. It's going to go from 44 interceptors to 64. They're adding a new missile field with 20 interceptors.
Well, this is good news. I have to say, though, that I must put a little bit of spotlight on the fact that, as you say, Bill, at least at the moment, and even under this expansion, we have a very limited supply of these defensive missiles, and the ability of the enemy to, overwhelm our capacity, especially for salvo launching multiple interceptors at a single warhead. We're not going to be able to do much to defend the United States against even perhaps an expanded North Korean threat, let alone, you know, what the Russians and Chinese are operating. So we really need to move, it seems to me, into much more efficient space-based defensive capabilities. And that's supposedly part of the plan, is it not? The missile defense review prescription for missile defenses in the future?
Yes. The good news is that the administration is clearly looking at it creating going back to the Strategic Defense Initiative days of the 80s and looking at being able to counter both beyond the North Korean and Iranian threats to the Chinese and Russian threats. Again, it's a much bigger undertaking, but I think the best way to go with that is with space-based interceptors, and they're definitely talking about that.
Yeah, well, I hope it's beyond talk, needless to say, but we'll be tracking your reporting on the subject. Bill, lastly, speaking of North Korea, I was very heartened to hear Secretary of State Mike Pompeo this week announced that we were going to maintain sanctions on North Korea until it denuclearizes. This is important, as is some of the sanction enforcement steps that the Treasury Department took, as you've reported, to punish Chinese companies that are violating those sanctions. Walk us through that, if you would, quickly.
Yeah, I had a piece this week that reported how the Treasury Department had announced the imposition of new sanctions on two Chinese entities, two companies that were engaged in at-sea transfers of energy resources, coal and oil and gas, gasoline at sea, in order to circumvent the sanctions.
That is to say, from Chinese platforms to North Korean ones to get around sanctions.
Or at least companies facilitating the transfer on ships that were flagged in third countries. But it's a good step that they're keeping the pressure on and hoping to do that. But Trump came out on the Friday, last Friday, a little less than a week ago, and said he was rescinding the sanctions, which it was not clear whether he was going to prevent further sanctions or was rescinding the sanctions on the two companies. And I've been unable to get clarification from the Treasury. They don't want to talk about it.
Oh. We have to leave it at that, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, Bill, come back to us again next week, if you would.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.